Can courage become a currency? Well, we're seeing it happen right now in Ukraine, which is transforming many of the stuck problems of Europe. We see the economic crimes bill that had been kicked onto the long grass by the Conservative government suddenly being put through this week, with the small chance that it tackles the London laundromat of dirty money from across the world. Unfortunately, we don't see Britain stepping up to the EU's offer to refugees from that crisis of 3 years without paperwork and any family connections with EU member states. The EU has also crossed the Rubicon to offer weaponry and money directly to Ukraine, almost stepping into the void that NATO has provided by declining Ukrainian membership. Everything is changing.
Those are the headlines. Now for the podcast.
Hi, Chums, and welcome to this week's Leslie British podcast. And, you know, I usually begin, you know, we try and begin a bit light-hearted, you know, a wee bit chat about the day. But, you know, with the news that's coming out of Ukraine, with the use of cluster bombs and other horrible weapons in Ukraine and what's been going on, I think we just go straight into it, Leslie. There is no avoiding, and nor should we be avoiding, the crisis that's unfolding in Ukraine and its impact right across the world, and particularly in Europe.
Yeah, I mean, it's we've been getting there for the last few weeks, but I mean, we're now right at the center of a complete, well, maelstrom, literally, for the people of Ukraine. And I think quite strongly we can talk about the implications for everybody else, but I think most Scots will just see this as nothing to do with any parallel of anything else. This is simply a moment for solidarity with Ukraine. And I noticed on STV News last night, great reports actually of the kind of humanitarian aid that's already being organised all over Scotland to go. First of all, they thought little van trips, and now they've organised great containers of stuff. Not quite sure how they'll get it there, but, you know, in previous conflicts, Scots have managed to get stuff to Syria, yeah, to all over the place. So already most people's instinct is to get out on squares with the Ukrainian flag, put the Ukrainian flag on their Facebook page, contribute. And I'm sure this will only increase now, is direct collections of of aid for Ukraine. So the instincts are all there, is like, you know, forget all the ramifications for everything else. Here's where we are. I mean, I noticed there was one letter to the Herald where there was a complaint from a businesswoman about Nicola Sturgeon managing to find 4 million quid down the back of the sofa when she told businesses that there was no money to help them out of COVID. I just don't think that's chiming with the times, especially, you know, I quite understand there's lots of difficulties for people. But, you know, we're sitting night after night watching nursery kindergarten teachers sitting making Molotov cocktails in gymnasiums. And we're watching young guys who are IT programmers, soft-handed lads, queuing up to be handed out their AK-47s. You know, this is just, come on. There's no equivalence now to the sort of minor difficulties we'll find here with the need for international solidarity. And I mean, just looking, I wrote a thing for the Herald about the parallels that exist with Finland, that went to war against the Russians in 1939 and did actually manage to repel them the first time round in 1939, to everyone's surprise, mostly of the Russians, who expected it would take 1 week to overcome Finland. But with the same sort of what Churchill described as sisu, well, it's a Finnish word, mm-hmm, which basically means smedum, utter smedum, the Finns were very well organised and acted as a kind of guerrilla army, and managed, a third of the population was in that army, and managed to push the Russians back the first time. But they reorganized and came back. And that then led the Finns into a path that allowed Germans, the Nazis, to use Finland so that they could try to retake the land and to retake Karelia, which is a part of Finland that has remained in Russian control. You know, Finland after that decided not to join NATO. It sort of understood that that was its path. It was to not suggest that there could ever be an American war base in Finland. And that became known as Finlandization, the suggestion that Finland was very conscious that its foreign policy had to be conducted with the fact of its long land border with Russia always carried in mind. And that was why Finland joined the European Union in 1995 and became probably its keenest member amongst all the Nordics, the only one to actually join the experiment of the euro and change its currency, because the EU is its security policy. Now look today, what's happening? The EU is absolutely weighing in to help Ukraine, pretty much because NATO won't or can't. So the EU is, in some respects, is stepping up in ways. We had someone on who was very involved with the EU Commission in a PALS question and answer session that we did last night. And it was fascinating for him to say the kind of sense of, excitement's not the right word, but just almost surprise, really, amongst a lot of staff that the EU has actually crossed the Rubicon and has decided to put money into weapons for Ukraine, which is, I mean, that's the EU. I'm not saying they're acting like a mini NATO, but they're certainly, that's not what the EU as a weights and measures department thought it was set up for. It's also today, the extraordinarily powerful, expressive and eloquent President Zelensky of Ukraine announced that they were formally bidding to become EU members. So essentially, they are sort of joining, it looks like, they're sort of joining the Finland path. If NATO isn't interested, they feel a need to get sheltered by some kind of European organization so that they're not essentially stuck out there on their own. Ursula von der Leyen has gone on record yesterday as saying that the EU will accept that Ukraine should become a member. But the question for everybody is how fast? All the little countries of Eastern Europe, Poland, Lithuania, Estonia, the Baltic republics, you know, all those newer accession countries that are part of that big eastern buffer zone have all come out, and former presidents of Sweden, Denmark and Finland have all come out saying there should be a special fast track devised for Ukraine to get into Europe. Now, that's going to be a really tough one for the EU, because everybody knows how stickily they are for observing all the niceties. Well, they're not niceties, all the conditions of matching the standards. And Ukraine just doesn't match them on all sorts of counts, including corruption. I mean, it's not like Ukraine was utterly a squeaky clean place before this. So, you know, there's a real dilemma now for the EU to have to face up to. And yet it's extraordinary that this beast that we all saw as this bureaucratic, slow, inflexible, unhelpful towards little countries. And I'm not saying Ukraine's little, it's got 44 million people and it's huge. But, you know, the underdogs were never the ones that seemed to catch the eye of the French and Germans, let's say. Things seem to be changing a bit. Also with the news yesterday that Germany has decided to remilitarize, which is an astonishing step given its history, but it's creating a special fund of 100 billion, now I expect euros, to rearm, to get its to essentially get up to the levels of contribution that NATO expects of members. So there's the most extraordinary realignment starting to happen in the wake of what's occurring. And of course, it's all of that when you see the limberness in some respects of what's happening. And let's chuck in the fact that the EU have just said that they'll take any refugee that can stay in any EU country for 3 years. There doesn't need to be any family connection, none, for them to come in. They'll deal with the paperwork later. And it's that contrast that makes Britain's appalling stance just look so miserly and you know, characteristic. There's a stage when you listen to Boris Johnson, you've got to say that many people felt he was in the region, felt that he was outspoken and going in the right direction. And then it just took that and that other appalling statement from Kevin Foster, you wouldn't believe, the Minister for Safe Migration, who said basically, you can come here and pick berries. So here's where we are today, and it's quite an extraordinary thing. And yet, you know, all of this is as of nothing. I just can't imagine what it's like to be sitting somewhere, you know, and it's been so graphically explained to us by extraordinarily clear-sighted people who are so eloquent, really, and so identifiable. They're sitting looking like they're sitting in the same setups that any of us would be, and standing in the queues, wearing the same sort of gear and whatever, you know, waiting to know if they'll ever get into Poland, if they'll ever see their husband that perhaps has been left behind. It's just mind-blowing, actually, to see the sort of situations that are playing out. And we need to, whatever we can do to pressure the British government, to shame them into a better refugee policy, to give direct aid to Ukraine. I mean, we need to be there now with no provisos, no conditionality on that one.
Yeah, I mean, that folk won't realise that this is the first time ever that the European Union has agreed the use of EU funds to buy arms for a country at war. And as Josep Borrell said, it's going to be fighter jets as well. So this is a massive deal, because individual countries such as Germany, Denmark and Sweden have already been sending aid in terms of arms, as has the UK in terms of support to the Ukraine. But this is the first time ever this has been done. And you compare and contrast, as you say, the rapidity of this, what was being represented to us as this monolithic bureaucratic setup of the European Union, with the you know, sitting in Strasbourg and having, you know, the dwarf sitting in Strasbourg organising everything. And you listened to Dominic Raab this morning, and I saw Dominic Raab this morning when he was attempting to explain away the Priti Patel statement that there would be 100,000 up to 100,000, and these would be dependents. And when questioned by Adil Ray, who said, well, does that mean an age a parent? Oh, well, you'll find out later in the next few days. And he got very flustered. But it appeared to be the fact that, no, you will not, if you're a Ukrainian living in the UK, settled status, you won't be able to bring in your parents under this. It will be purely dependents, and a very narrow definition, and comparing and contrasting entirely with what the European Union is doing. And we were supposed to be leaving the European Union in order to be freer and more open, make our own decisions, be quick and nimble on the international stage. And you're absolutely right. The EU is doing far more quickly, and a more caring and sympathetic and empathetic way to the plight of the Ukrainian people.
But some of that, I mean, we'll doubtless come back to the business of, you know, our British position on the refugees. But some of that, this is what the European Union is about, because it has in membership countries that have borders with Russia. It makes a difference to the outlook of those countries which haven't, because you have to sit there and take on their pain. You have to listen to their concerns. And today, I mean, I was listening to the Today programme, and there was a guy on whose contribution was, I thought, utterly jaw-dropping. I actually was one of those ones where I was listening online, so I was able to wheeze the thing back to make sure I caught it all.
Yeah.
But it was a guy called Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who was a former ally, an oligarch, a former ally of Putin. But Putin went for one of his friends in 2003. He came out in support of his friend and was imprisoned, and then fled Russia and now lives in London. And he conducted most of the interview in Russian, except for one point when he was asked about his own connections, because his grandfather was Ukrainian. And very impressively and quite movingly, he switched into sort of stumbling English just for that answer, and said, basically, my motherland is bombing my motherland, you know, because I suppose this makes arguments about the interchangeability of some of the population, and just said, it splits me, you know, which was incredibly powerful. But the point he was making was, he said, he thinks that the psychological state that Putin is in, especially if he manages to take Ukraine, he said, he will just keep going. And he said, if he will break NATO and punish NATO, and what he will try to achieve is that they go to war, or that NATO goes to war or dissolves itself. And he said that what he will try to do is create a corridor to Kaliningrad. Now, have you ever heard of Kaliningrad?
Oh, gosh, at the back of my mind, right. It's there, well, Lizzie, but I can't recall.
So the point is, I thought, what? And that's the one that I had to go back over four times to get the name of it rightly, had a quick look at it. And I just thought, my God, I just didn't know any of this. Kaliningrad is a tiny little exclave, which, of course, is the opposite to an enclave.
Yeah.
It sits essentially like Russia's West Berlin, mm-hmm. on the Baltic coast, between Poland and Lithuania. It's got 400,000 people, 87% of whom are Russian. However, it mostly, I mean, when you look at the long list of who's owned that bit of land, it's moved between an awful lot of people, but mostly Germans. It was called Königsgrad. I've just lost all my notes here. Anyway, it had a German name, mm-hmm. for a very long time, until, in fact, the Second World War. So it was really within Prussian, German domain until the Second World War, when, in part of the shameful deal that also handed off all the Baltic republics, yeah. to the Soviet Union, that exclave was handed over. Well, of course, at that point, it was surrounded by other bits of the Soviet Empire. So in a sense, it didn't really matter very much. And then over the years, of course, if you actually look on the map, it's quite instrumental. If you can imagine it going from north to south, you've got sort of Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, all pretty much packed almost on, sort of on top of one another. You've got, gosh, now I'm stumbling, you've got Belarus and then Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So the only thing that stops the joining up is a tiny bit of Poland. Oh, but that tiny bit of Poland contains Warsaw.
Right.
So if you look at that map and then go back to what that guy said, and he said, you know, this is the mentality of the guy. What he will do is he will try to create a corridor connecting Kharkiv, which is the city that has undergone this, mm-hmm. appalling bombing. And Kharkiv is right on the border with Russia. So that would give, if you then were to sort of, you know, if they took Ukraine, he's already essentially got Belarus as a kind of client, yeah. state. It's not a huge stretch to be able to push through to Poland, then to connect to Kaliningrad. And the relevance of that is it is the only ice-free port in the Baltic.
Okay.
Yeah. And it already, you know, there's been negotiations over the years. There was plans to house nuclear weapons there. There were threats in 2009, which were then, that one was kind of knocked on the head. But it's described, it was one of the host cities for the 2018 World Cup. It was described as the best city in Russia for business by Forbes magazine in 2013. You know, it's an extraordinary thing, but it's the easternmost city. It was the easternmost city of Germany. It's now this exclave of Russia. Now, is that what he's thinking? Because then if you look at that, if there was that corridor created, it completely separates the Baltic republics from the rest of Europe.
Yeah.
Not allied to invading Poland. And people might, with a bit of history, any bit of history, might remember invading Poland had quite a lot to do with where we were in the Second World War.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, just that one contribution. Now, who knows? He could be wrong. You know, he could be out of touch. But I kind of suspect from the mere fact that most of his conversation was conducted in Russian, his mind is still, I guess his contacts are still very much, you know, in a Russian sphere. And that really is completely sobering, because you suddenly see why many things, why all those those states immediately joined NATO when they could in 2004-05. And you, I guess as well, why the Russians watch that and then see, you know, essentially this balance of power that's constantly swept across that part of the continent changing, and them wanting to have essentially neutral buffers all the way around them that they can control.
Yeah, I mean, and the just a point you made earlier and was about the European Union, of just reflecting on the European Union having member states from Central and Eastern Europe within it. And one of Rab's statements about the refugees, not migrants, BBC Scotland, refugees, was the fact that they could remain in Central and Eastern Europe. So again, it's, you know, let's just keep our border separate, not let these Eastern Europeans in. And what we're employing, Leslie, is are sanctions. And when, again, I did the same thing. The sanctions were imposed in 2014 and have never been removed against Russia for its invasion of the Crimea. But they've taken a step forward this time with the SWIFT banking system. And the SWIFT banking system is set up to allow international to messages to be sent about international transfers of money. And that could, they think, cripple Russia's ability to trade with the rest of the world. And it's already had an effect on the ruble. The ruble's plummeted against the dollar. And lots of Russians, because of the issue that arose in 2014 with the financial crash they had there and the initial imposition of sanctions and the fall in the ruble, and even since the creation of modern Russia, have kept their money in dollars. But that's now crashed, the ruble against the dollar. Interest rates have doubled from 10% to 20%, so the sanctions will be biting ordinary people. And in any democratic society, that would be a major implication for the leader of that country, Putin. But it is a totalitarian society, and will Putin be able just to shrug all this off? You know, because what the people think, you know, is utterly irrelevant as long as he keeps the oligarchs on board. And the hope is, I presume, that the deal that's been done with SWIFT, which is striking at the major Russian financial institutions, 80% of the banks, that this will impact the oligarchs and they will put the pressure on Putin to rein back. I mean, but I honestly don't know. Given the fact that those sanctions are in place in 2014 and Putin survived that, will he survive these?
Well, yes. I mean, we discussed this last week because I wrote a column about this. I think it was for the Herald then, about the economic crimes bill that the British government had fully planned to knock into the long grass 10 days ago and do in the next session of Parliament. And now it's doing it tomorrow. So, you know, what a difference a week makes. But, you know, one of the condemnations of previous actions that had been brought forward by all sorts of experts on this was enforcement. Of course, there's all sorts of stuff on paper that looks pretty robust. But the point they were all making was how weak all the various crime agencies in Britain are, and how strong the lawyers of the kind of oligarchs that were being targeted are. And in fact, again, on today, there was a fascinating contribution from Misha Glenny, who many people will remember as a brilliant BBC correspondent, who is making the point that actually today, a guy called Tom Burgess, who wrote a book, Kleptopia, is in court, having tackled, I think he's put vague, you know, in general terms, Central European oligarchs. Well, they've now got the actual author of that book in court. And they're using what are called SLAPs, which are strategic lawsuits against public participation suits, which are actually being whacked on all sorts of journalists who are doing big, deep investigative work, which the British government wasn't, because it hadn't got its own agencies staffed up enough to do the job. Now, if the Economic Crimes Bill goes through, as per previous conversation, it should do quite a lot to beef up enforcement and to change the balance of power within a lot of the court setups. But, you know, that's going to take a bit of time. I mean, in the meantime, that will take time to land. In the meantime, your man, Khodorkovsky, the chap I was referring to before, said that he thinks that the psychological state that Putin is in is such that he'll only really negotiate when he realizes he's stuck in Ukraine.
Yeah.
And so he said it all actually hinges on the Ukrainians keeping him out of Kiev and out of the big cities, so that this, what some people might think is a desperate, noble and doomed to failure, futile resistance, is utterly important, because he's not, this chap Khodorkovsky thinks that Putin is not really receptive, pretty obviously, to public opinion or even oligarch opinion within Russia, as much as realizing that he has become stuck. Now, I mean, it's hard. He thinks now, this chap Khodorkovsky thought initially, that unfortunately the Russians would just sweep through Ukraine and occupy it for a very long time, albeit that quite evidently with the resistance we're seeing, it would be one of those things where it's maybe relatively easy to occupy a place. As per Afghanistan, it's extremely hard to hold it and the Russian population hold that memory of the failure and the terrible cost in Russian lives in their mission in Afghanistan. So that one looks ready to play it again. But, you know, he says he believes that Putin will realize he shot himself in the foot only when he is unable to progress. And of course, that's the thing that brings us back to the vacuum bombs, the, you know, the horrible warfare, the cluster bombs that are being used, because the attempt to just roll in and kind of hope that it just scared everyone enough that there could be a relatively light movement into Ukraine hasn't worked. So absolutely, now the big, horrible stuff gets used. But that also demands the reaction that the EU has moved on to pretty much arm up the Ukrainians. I notice in things when the EU guys are speaking, they're even talking about the kind of weapons. And as you mentioned, the aircraft that are being given to Ukraine have got to be the ones that the Ukrainians are already familiar with using. So it's extremely bespoke is what is kind of happening at the moment. And yet you still got to look at it and think, what is it? The Russians are the second largest, you know, military force on earth. If they really want to bomb Ukraine into the ground and they can do it without nuclear weapons, they can do it.
Yeah. I mean, and watching the reaction over here of the UK government, and one of the things that particularly struck me was the praise for the anti-war protesters in Russia. I just get the kind of feeling, I don't know if you do, Leslie, if there was that kind of anti-war protest that was going on over here under the new policing bill, it would be banned because it's too noisy, too disruptive, and these would be horrible peaceniks who are anti-patriotic, you know. But we can praise it over there, but not over here, because when we go to war, I mean, and Putin's denazification is his equivalent of the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. I mean, that's the nature of the beast that we can see there, is the ability to use naked power if you are a powerful nation. And what we're seeing, though, is if one ignores what went on in the former Yugoslavia, because many people are doing that, that this is taking place on a European stage. And that's the impact that's having on people, because these proxy wars have been fought elsewhere. And the nearly a million that have been killed in Yemen and in Afghanistan and in Iraq, no, we can ignore all that. But when it comes to the fact that it's on our own doorsteps, that is a significant impact. But again, the hypocrisy.
Just to jump in case anyone is thinking Pat is saying we should ignore Yemen and blah, 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 in how you, that was phrased. I know you don't mean that. And actually, there have been quite a few folk coming in with those legitimate points, you know, that as ever, it looks as if we jump to it when we've got something that looks like it's in our sphere and have managed to ignore the massive destabilization of countries that are further away. And as I think you've had a look at, the racism there's been actually just spoils the copybook of this whole thing, because it looks like it's happened to some degree on the Ukrainian and Polish sides.
Yeah, well, I mean, the racism I was looking at, I mean, you are correct, because there appears to be, there is this streak of reactionary racism there, where if you're black, they've been pushed back at the borders, and I mean, measures been trying to be put in place by various governments in order to alleviate the difficulties that black refugees are having trying to get across the border, for example, being turned back saying you're not Ukrainian. But specifically, it was the coverage, Leslie. I mean, someone put up on Twitter, and that's how I began to realise this was going on, the reporting of the conflict, Charlie Degatta of CBS. This isn't a place, with all due respect, like Iraq or Afghanistan, that's seen conflict raging for decades. This is a relatively civilised, relatively European city where you wouldn't expect that type of thing to happen. And Kelly Kobelia of NBC was even more explicit. These are not refugees from Syria. They're Christians. They're white. And ITN's Lucy Watson was the one that shocked me as well. Now the unthinkable has happened to them. And this is not a developing third world nation. This is Europe. And it is that Eurocentric perspective, Leslie, that's pervading some of the reporting that's going on and some of the impact. And there's currently a major wave of sympathy towards Ukrainians, as I said before, who would be the type of Eastern European migrant that people who supported Brexit would be, many of them would not want to be in this country in the first place. So we have that, the Ukrainians being made European for the first time and moving up that ladder because of the horrific events that are taking place. And I'm not downplaying this to any extent at all. I despise war. I despise totalitarian regimes of any stripe. And I firmly believe in the right of individual countries and peoples to take up arms to defend themselves from incursion from foreign governments. All. And it's, but it is that aspect of it that this seems to be striking deep. And that's been revealed by these statements by experienced journalists revealing that Eurocentric perspective where this only matters because these are white, blue-eyed people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And actually, I thought you might have also mentioned, you know, the stuff that's been recorded by students and various other trainees from the sort of Asian subcontinent who were in Ukraine and were trying to cross in the routes across to Poland and claimed with picture evidence that they were being held back while white Ukrainians were being allowed over.
Yeah.
And they also claimed that the Ukrainian side was also interfering with their passage. So, you know, I mean, they say all's fair in, you know, love and war. This is absolutely not fair. But all those instincts, if they sit in a population and racism does, will come to the fore at a moment where, let's face it, if you watch the, again, excellent coverage by Channel 4 News with Matt Fry in the station at Kiev, white Ukrainians are pulling other white Ukrainians out of the way to get their children on board those trains. Mm-hmm. So, nobody, you know, in moments of absolute panic, the kind of sense of who gets through and who doesn't is a really keen one for anybody in the moment to have to deal with. And yet, you know, standing back from it, which is where we are, I can only say that the reason that I think Europe is so focused on this, the EU that is particularly, is because of the enlargement to include these small buffer states. Who have made, Estonia, and, you know, forgive me, I know a wee bit about that because I made a film about it so recently. But, you know, Estonia is, it now houses the EU's digital security centre. It's become so good because of its huge emphasis on digital services and because it made that tiger leap, as they describe it, in their economy in the last 30 years to become absolutely at the forefront of all sorts of digital knowledge. The whole EU's HQ for digital security is in Tallinn in Estonia. It's not like these guys have been regarded as wee diddy countries mm-hmm. that don't really matter and haven't been, you know, given a share of the goodies. Quite a few of them have become big muscular players who have taken their turn in NATO as well, in chairing, years of leadership and so on. And that, I think, impacts eventually on the mentality of Berlin and Paris.
Yeah.
So these guys, in the same way as maybe people were surprised at how much the EU essentially backed Ireland's case. Yeah. Well, why wouldn't they? Because Ireland's a member, you know. It's like this is what having a big, it's like if you've got a very varied selection of friends. And people may now be discovering that because I would think there's not a person listening who doesn't have a friend of a friend who's a Ukrainian who hasn't already had the ideas that they've got supplemented. Even I went along to the famous Wormat Spar and was talking to one of the lads at the checkout there. And one of his best friends is a Ukrainian. And his the stories he was getting back were then being relayed via him to me. I'm telling you, you know, this is... These networks of contacts are what creates our bigger ideas about international solidarity. It's not a big remote, of course, it has that big remote high stage quality as well. But just in our own everyday lives, there's enough connections here that people have embraced. And I think also within Scotland anyway, a sort of fairly laid backness and acceptance of Eastern Europeans in our lives has kind of done that as well. I mean, I remember when I was over in Dublin just a couple of weeks ago, one of the great delights of the thing was the number, you know, it was back to how things used to be here, where there was a real mixture of nationalities around, and many of them were East European, very polite, competent, as we now know, clear-eyed, straightforward people who were part of the big, you know, hurdy-gurdy that is the Irish population. We've lost that, and I think we never had a chance to grieve that. We never were able to speak particularly about that because we were just wheeched out, and, you know, everything that happened subsequently was covered by COVID and, I guess, many shortcomings by the British government about energy policy over decades will now be laid at the feet of President Putin. I see also, just while we're at it, that the European Parliament is right now considering whether to put an embargo on oil and gas imports.
Yes.
So, you know, all of this will absolutely impact on us, and never mind 4 million quid being found down the sofa, which could have gone to businesses in Scotland. You know, there will be absolute impacts on in all sorts of ways, but nothing compared to the massive impact sitting at the centre of Ukraine. And it's absolutely, this is our continent. We are geographically, geopolitically located here. It's the reason that many of us wanted to be in the EU, because it was an answer to the constant shifting of national territory that has been the story of Europe. And it's why many of us feel vexed that we're not within an organisation that must step up to deal with the people who are trying to join. I mean, if Ukraine can't join NATO and it can't join the EU, what are we saying?
Yeah.
What we're saying is it's Russian.
Yes.
And then what we're saying is Putin is perfectly within his rights to essentially come and liberate Ukraine from this misapprehension that that Europe gave a toss.
Yeah.
So there's just unfortunately, this is a difficult one, and it will always be difficult. You know, but the thing is, having spoken to the guys that you know in Estonia, it's always difficult for them. You know, there is never not going to be a border with Russia. It's difficult for Finland. There's never not going to be a border there. But they've lived and thrived.
Yeah.
And Ukraine can do that, but only if people's mindset is that this matters.
Well, meanwhile, out with the EU, we see Liz Truss doing her posing in front of the Union flag and Ukrainian flag, you know, never missing the opportunity, you know, to stand in front of flags. And James Cleverly, in a reply to David Lammy on Question Time, claiming it was racist to question UK citizens of Russian heritage donating to the Conservative Party. And it was justified because of the Tory party's opposition to the dangerous Jeremy Corbyn. You know, I mean, it's the utter
Honest to God, this is why I don't watch that programme.
Yeah.
I mean, how was your blood pressure watching that?
Well, I mean, I'm surprised you didn't hear me down the road screaming at them. You know, I mean, oh, my family came here and this and that, and you're going, oh, for God's sake, man, this is just, you are, it's utterly ridiculous to try and make that argument. And I mean, I don't know if they believe it or not, but I mean, they're trying, I mean, over 2 million quid donated. And when you actually look at some of the folk that have been given the money, Lubov Chernugin, £700,000, wife of Vladimir Chernugin, ex-Putin finance minister, Temerko Amersi, two others with significant Putin-Russian, you know, Russian connections. And then you have Jacob Rees-Mogg. And isn't this just timing wonderful? Jacob Rees-Mogg, who's far back as 2014, who's been questioned during Crimea because he was standing up making statements that Theresa May wasn't hard enough on Russia, to be turned around and said, well, wait a minute, mate. The company that you're involved in, you take nearly £14,000 a month for 30 hours a year work, you know, has got £60 million invested in Sberbank, you know, which is the largest state banking institution in Russia. You know, and funnily enough, you know, just a few weeks before we put all these sanctions in place, Jacob Rees-Mogg's company just happens to withdraw its millions, nearly £50 million worth of shares in Sberbank. You know, they must think we are absolute mugs. No, they really must do, because capital moves around and it suits itself. And you're going to see the share value of certain companies go right through the roof because we're engaged in a situation where it is on a war footing and people will make millions out of it while the Ukrainians are dying for their freedom. And it just reveals, it pulls the sticking plaster off the stinking wound that is the international banking system, the international finance system, and the rotten corruption of the British political system dating right back to the bad boys of Brexit and the corruption of the US political system as well by Russian money.
Yeah, and before that, I mean, I remember that lawyer who I think was killed by the mafia, Roberto, I can't remember his second name, but he was the one who coined that phrase. And this is long back, describing London as the money laundering capital of the world. So like that's just been in with the BRICS for, you know, for probably a century. This is a long-standing feature of the fact that Britain chose as a colonial power to essentially steal other people's goods and make money from trading them. So, you know, we stopped becoming a manufacturing power in our minds a long time ago when, you know, our own oligarchs decided that it was easier for them to export capital to invest in colonial areas where they would make a far bigger return because people were paid nothing. And thus investment in our own society dwindled and we were on the road to becoming what we are today. So the City of London was given primacy because it trades other people's stuff, some of which, you know, is still the ill-gotten goods that sit in the British Blooming Museum, which people from those countries pay money to see. It's their stuff. But anyway, you know, so the City of London's primacy and the no, you know, the decision to turn blind eyes to everything that goes on in the name of, you know, just money, that's a just such an entrenched part of being British, actually. I mean, the thing about the Tories is they're not embarrassed about it. You know, it's all hiding in plain sight with them. And of course, they can ladle on a bit of kind of whatever rhetoric they need for the occasion, as Boris Johnson is doing at the moment.
Oh, yeah.
But if they manage to actually do, just for example, the tightening up on Companies House, this sounds so boring, but you know, they can't remember who it was I quoted in the article a couple of weeks ago, making the point that anyone from anywhere in the world can set up a company in 10 minutes for £12 with no questions asked about where the money comes from. Shell companies can be set up. You can then be based in offshore tax havens perfectly legitimately, and no amount of protests from people about the impact that has had for decades, particularly in Scotland, on the ownership of land and the shape of our society. None of that has had any sort of impact whatsoever. However, if the Scottish Limited Partnerships, which are apparently another very useful vehicle to jump on and set up these kind of companies, if that gets clamped down on, if people have to expose what the true ownership of land, property, houses, you know, the whole nine yards actually is, then that does begin to bring Britain back onto a sort of, you know, same level playing field with where the rest of Europe has been for a very long time. I somehow struggle to think that this will find its way through for that very reason. But I mean, this is where politically the pressure has got to be kept on, because the circumstances have absolutely produced the most extraordinary about turn from the Tories on this economic crimes bill alone. Everybody is having to sort of basically tighten their act up in extraordinary ways. The next things we'll have to think about here are, of course, we get most of our gas from Norway, but still the price will go up with shortage. So this is why we absolutely need independence to be able, because there's another era starting. Many eras are ending simultaneously. The oil era is over. But the era of then having a sort of get out clause by sucking up other people's remnants of fossil fuels, that's over. I mean, we may think we're lucky at the moment because we have gas supplies from a stable country, Norway. But that only means we'll be the last ones to actually grasp the nettle. And that will not make us the lucky ones. It hasn't made us the lucky ones, because we are so dependent on gas because it was easy that we are now the ones facing shortages, albeit Norway, and prices going through the roof. So there's a moment, and there's a moment where there has to be a wholesale shift in how we deal with with energy. And I don't think there's a single person I could meet today who would say Westminster is better suited to do that now.
Yeah.
So it's all we're waiting for, as ever, is the case to be put forward succinctly by the Scottish Government as to why the future that needs a major turnaround is something that can be done. And here's our plan for energy. Just energy alone is just such a massive one suddenly. But still, I mean, that's, you know, pretty far ahead at the moment. This is just a situation where every morning you wake up and it seems that the Russians are now doing most of their damage at night because it's safer for them under cover of darkness. So it seems like, you know, the mornings are pretty grim as you wake up to hear what the next thing is that's happened.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about tightening acts up. We haven't, Ofcom is considering banning Russia today. In the UK, it's already been, you know, it's already happening right across Europe. And a bit of a stooshy when you suggested, I believe quite rightly, that Alex Salmond shouldn't have just have suspended his programme on Russia Today, but it should actually, you know, have stopped broadcasting on Russia Today.
Absolutely. I mean, as you know, when people listen to this, I just try not to get involved in any he said, she says, because it's completely pointless, really. And absolutely, I've had pelters from many people who are saying, well, where else can Alex broadcast? Do you know, that is a subsidiary issue. It's like, you know, big issue, relatively small issue. And I'm sorry, folks, the world is not entirely, at moments of crisis like this, seen purely through the prism of how someone who has been in the past a very stalwart supporter and leader of the independence cause in Scotland now fares. That is not as significant as the need to isolate everything to do with Russia. I forced myself actually to go on and watch Russia Today just in case I was actually being unfair and they were being actually a little bit, you know, it was actually jaw-dropping the strange contrast there was. Actually, the presenter was using words like Russian invasion and terrible catastrophe and stuff, and I thought, God, maybe I've underestimated these guys. But the correspondent who'd been brought in was giving all the Putin lines, you know, about saving people from themselves in Ukraine, about, you know, then they had spurious news reports with sort of apparent damage that the Ukrainians had done to people in the eastern enclaves of you know, the separatist areas of Ukraine. It was absolute, it was actually propaganda TV at its most accomplished. Because if you weren't really awake, you wouldn't have noticed that you were just getting subtly a complete reworking. And in fact, the fact, in a funny kind of way, that the presenter was fairly anchored in his language, with the language that's being used in Western TV, however you want to pronounce it, you know, define that, was actually more skillful because it sort of lulled you into a kind of, oh, this is our guys, basically, because of the way the presenter was pushing the discussion. But the way that the responses were coming from all the correspondents that were there, and there was, obviously no one on the ground for Russia TV in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So there was all sorts of third hand things, you know, from social media clips. No. You know, this was just not okay. And there's no point to go back in history. You can have your arguments. I'm not that, you know, interested in them, really, as to whether Alex should or should never have taken up the RT thing. I think I've never been on his programme, though my memory is so bad. I'm pretty sure I haven't. I know I was on once or twice as an independence supporter. Until the Salisbury poisonings. And then, I mean, after that, it's like, what the hell? Everybody waking up. This is what you've got. You've got to have a situation where there are just some avenues you just choose not to take in life. And personally speaking, you know, there's many of us who have essentially, because of our support for independence, found ourselves out on a limb, shall we say. In fact, this podcast is... is living proof, because
exactly,
you know, Chris started this in 2007. I think that might have been, I can't remember quite the timings of Alex's movements, but you know, I could see that I was, you know, pretty much out of my ear after the you know, the indie ref all work stopped for me out with the columns I've got. All the stuff I'd had, you know, facilitating things and some expertise I might have built up in certain areas was now no longer useful. Well, dems are breaks, right? Okay, I'm not the former First Minister of Scotland, so you might say there's a status issue there. And you might say that actually one of the difficulties is that because the SNP rightly doesn't put anybody forward for the House of Lords, there's nowhere to put its former statespeople. And you might also say that until Alex Salmond did accomplish that extraordinary victory in 2011, particularly when, you know, there was a majority, there weren't any former statespeople enough because nobody had actually ever been an SNP First Minister. This is the telescope nature of the extraordinary changes that have happened in Scottish democracy, that you suddenly have this larger than life figure who you might also say could have been given a job somewhere trotting around Europe, you know, glad handing or doing some sort of outreach work. You could say all of those things. But just right now where we are, everybody has got to isolate Russia. That's it. Just simple. And not, you don't isolate them when you start talking about suspension, because that's their thing. They know. And the foreign minister has said, the Russian's foreign minister, what happens is that Europe has a flutter. This is what happened in 2014 with the first invasion. But they come back because they're addicted. They're addicts. They're junkies. They're junkies for the oil. They're junkies for the gas. They're junkies for the wheat. We've got all this stuff here. And in the end, because you guys are dependent on us, you'll make all these noises. We can just sit it out and you'll be back.
Yeah.
So it's this notion that all of us will basically be back and that we're not really serious about anything that happens now. It doesn't need any further feeding that narrative. That's the thing. So it must be quitting. You know, it must be the principled stand, because suspension also implies, what would it take for it now to be OK to work for RT again?
Absolutely. Yeah.
I don't even want to go down that avenue, but that calculation is just one I wouldn't want to associate myself with in any shape or form. So that's why I can't remember what I actually put, but I said, you know, suspension, no, this should be quitting.
Yeah.
The, you know, permanently end of, you know, like the end, not a sort of, you know, just a circling of you know, just keeping that vague connection. So I pelters, whatever, you know, well, I mean, that's all right. But I would imagine now we're in a situation where it's perfectly obvious that, you know, the Russian ballet has been cancelled in Edinburgh. These ballet dancers didn't do anything wrong. There was people even putting things up saying, actually, some of them possibly want asylum from Russia. You know, I mean, so we should let them come so they can all come and stay here if they want. I mean, this is how changed things are, even within a couple of days. So, I think that's the size of it.
Yeah, I don't. And my perspective is, if FIFA are now willing to ban Russian national teams from playing, and UEFA have banned Russian national and club teams from playing, two of the most corrupt organisations in world sport, I think Alex Salmond should take a wee think to himself and actually say, no, it's immoral. I'll stop it. And to say, Ofcom investigating because of this, as you quite clearly said, you watched RT, I watched QT, and I think we both deserve medals for doing it. And talking of deserving medals and stories for that you were talking about in narratives, there's a new Bella Caledonia anthology, I believe, containing some very interesting writing that's been produced and edited by Mike Small.
It's absolutely brilliant. I have it here in my hands at the moment, the anthology of writing from 2007 to 2021. And it's a really brilliant wee kind of anthology of stuff. Here's a bit. A.L. Kennedy wrote a tremendous piece about Britain. I can't quite see the date on it, but I mean, she was describing it as a country where the public discourse is a hell's broth of gossip, malign invention, racism, rabble-rousing hatred and smut. You know, so that she's really going for it. And in the sort of terms of where we are with the current debate about, you know, about racism and everything we've talked today, you read these things afresh with incredible, you know, different relevance. There's another one that was a bit of a classic back in the day when Peter Arnott, the playwright and author, wrote an essay in July of 2014, just before the referendum, Dinner with No Voters, or what I wanted to say before the pudding hit the fan. and I mean, this is, again, it's just extraordinary how relevant that still is. You know, his whole idea was to challenge the narrative of no voters about how divisive the referendum was and their wish that it would all just go away. And we quote from that. He says, I take issue with my friends who are still my friends in their imagining that a no vote somehow cancels uncertainty and division, that life will ever again be like this never happened. So, I mean, that's, again, a really fascinating piece. There's so many bits in here, actually. I mean, it feels bad when I'm sort of highlighting one. Yeah. It kind of, but then there's another from my friend Alistair McIntosh, who set up the Centre for Human Ecology, examining the psychohistory of Donald Trump and saying, you know, when I look at Trump, his colossal egotism, his grandiosity, his disconnect from all empathy, I see a man who nurses a narcissistic wound, a wound to his integrity, from places he probably doesn't even know exists. And that's just on his mother's side. You know, wow. So there's really incredible writing in this. So I'd say this is a great one for everybody just to kind of take stock of where we've come to. Because, I mean, even in that last discussion there, Scotland has just been through the most extraordinary change, really, within the period of the last 10 years. Just unbelievable. Just give it about 15 years, really. We've just changed out of all recognition. And this book is kind of a map of that changing, both changing reality and the way that certain underlying things remain absolutely true. So, you know, anyway, this is a big plug. But if you want to find it, you'll find it anywhere online. It's $12.99, incredible value, and doubtless Pat will put a link up on the podcast.
Yes, I shall do that. And back to the podcast, we had this is the morning after the night before, because we started out doing an hour question and answer session with some of our pals on a Zoom call last night.
Those will be subscriber pals, in case anybody's thinking pals, these are just our little personal pals.
God, those are a lot of personal files. We'll just keep that one quiet. Who do not exist, I hasten to add. But yes, those are the subscriber pals. How long did it last as opposed to the hour, Ms. Riddick?
I don't know. It was 3 hours in the end.
Two and a quarter hours as we timed it. But it was an absolute delight and really interesting to hear from people. And it was by way of being a thank you to those who subscribe as pals. And it was enlightening to hear the views that are coming about. And we talked a lot of focus on the local elections, which are kind of creeping up on us and are kind of being submerged, even though Douglas Ross was traipsing about Dundee yesterday, apparently. I don't know how that would have gone down with my fellow Dundonians. Not no affy well, I reckon.
Well, but he was at a blooming food bank in the Healeman's umbrella in Glasgow and got roundly tilt out of that. But yes, I mean, it was fascinating with people. I mean, just really sharing the difficulty of being stuck as we are in politics here, because there's quite a lot of dissatisfaction in local areas with the kind of policies that have come from the SNP in some quarters, or the stuckness of things, the sort of just churning out stuff that isn't specific to the actual problems that, and it's not local democracy, this is regional democracy, because these are not local, as anyone else would understand it, elections. But we also heard from Orkney, I mean, fascinating insight from Fiona there about actually that boat, the Russian boat that's been kind of, packed out, and the difficulty for it actually, and the reason that the Orcadians are very animated about it is not just even so much that it is a Russian boat, but that all boats that come in to take in oil in Scapa Flow have to do a very elaborate business of taking water on to create a ballast for themselves, and then discharging the ballast mostly at sea, but some of it in the flow itself, which means they're taking in water. There's all sorts of complications for water purity and everything else there. Who knew? You know,
it was brilliant. But all in all, it was an absolutely great evening, fascinating in particular to listen to people. And it was from all sorts of areas of Scotland about their own continuing campaigns and hopes for a future independence referendum. By the way, sorry, I nearly forgot about this when you set me off on a little trail when you were talking about Finland. And it's just a little addendum, because these daft things appeal to me, that I discovered that there were a significant number of volunteers went to fight in Finland with the Finns in their battle against the invasion by the Soviet Union, including one Christopher Lee, the actor, who then went on to play Dracula. And other things. But so Christopher Lee was a volunteer in what Hitler referred to as the Sisu battalions, as you said, in the fight for Finnish independence against the invasion by the Soviet Union.
My God.
There you go.
Well, and then when I was looking at Kaliningrad, which used to be, you know, essentially part of Germany, it turns out that Immanuel Kant was born, the philosopher was born in Kaliningrad, probably its most famous son. Uh-huh. And there's a massive rame. There was a massive rame recently about what to rename the airport, which, well, I was going to say brought to mind the George Best International Airport thing for Belfast, except there was no rame there. Everyone went, yeah, fine, whatever, you know. But because this was described even then, this was back in maybe about 10 years ago, this discussion, and it wasn't named after him. It was described by the Russian authorities in Kaliningrad as a Nazi move to describe an airport after Immanuel Kant. I mean, it's a funny blooming old world, you know, where all these you start to trace down, especially when you move across Europe, you find all these, you know, fascinating sort of, when I say stories, it again conjures up stories, always conjures up the wrong words. It sounds like colouring books and Burns things and whatever. But it's these narratives that we just haven't taken on board, because at school we were all taught American history, the war, but as pertains to our side of Europe and the rest of how it impacted on the, you know, it's just been allowed to go swivel. But they're really there, you know, and by gum, are we ever realising that now?
Yeah, and on that philosophical note, we'll see you next week, Jones.